Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today has breaking news on fishes. He claims that they are sentient, aware, social, and even Machiavellian. In other words, much like us. Jonathan Balcom is a biologist who specializes in animal behavior and emotions. He is the director of animal sentience at the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy and the author of four books, including Second Nature and Pleasurable Kingdom. He has appeared on the BBC, Terry Gross's Fresh Air, the National Geographic Channel, and in several documentaries. He is a contributor of features and opinions to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Nature, and other publications. Jonathan Balcom's latest book is What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. Jonathan Balcom, welcome.
Hi, Nancy. Thanks for having me.
Why did you write this book about fishes?
They're so misunderstood. We've so underestimated them. In my job as a scientist who keeps an eye on the scientific trends in what we know about animals and their lives, over the years, I've encountered a lot of really interesting new discoveries about fishes that are being published in the scholarly literature. But I'm acutely aware that most of this information does not filter up to the general public. And so I felt the time was ripe and overdue for an up-to-date overview of what fishes' lives are like, what they do, their social lives, their sex lives, their perceptual worlds, their intelligence, their emotion. And I'm very much an animal advocate, so I also wanted to provide a context of concern and care and consideration for these animals, because they really have been relegated to the cellar of our moral consideration when it comes to vertebrate animals.
You were saying it doesn't filter out to the general public, but I was wondering, too, if veterinary schools are receptive to your research and your conclusions. Are they teaching what you're discovering?
I frankly don't know the answer to that. I suspect there's very little specifically about fish cognition and emotion being taught at veterinary schools. There may be exceptions to that. I would hope that that the curriculum of a typical vet school does touch on fishes, but certainly you don't hear too much about fish veterinarians. I have spoken at a number of vet schools over the years. I'm always happy to do so. It's usually organized by the students themselves, which is fine. It's great. And I hope that their influence is felt by their faculty. I think just generally, we're in a time where we are seeing moral progress in terms of our awareness and concern and consideration and respect for other animals. We have a huge way to go, but we're definitely going in the right direction now. And certainly the veterinary profession is an important part of that change that we need to see happen.
Well, you might explain why, when I ask you about your book on fishes, why I didn't say fish, because that's typically what we say, a book about fish.
Yeah, it was a point I wanted to make really early in the book. It's one of the many ways, subtle and otherwise, that we tend to diminish this group of animals, this incredibly rich, complex, successful group of animals, is by pluralizing the word fish as the word fish. When I go hiking, I don't say I saw 7 mammal and 11 bird. I put an S at the end. And while the word fishes is certainly acceptable, it's an acceptable alternative. It's typically only used when referring to more than one species. Well, a core message of my book is that we're talking about individuals who are unique, who have not just biology, but biographies. And so it was important to me, I think it's important to me, how we use language to refer to animals. And by just referring to them all as just the fish, we're kind of, I feel like we're a little bit linguistically undermining their individuality and uniqueness as individuals. So I felt like the word fishes is more appropriate.
And you just said that each fish is a unique individual, not just a biology, but a biography. How can you determine a fish's biography?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, in terms of the kind of nuanced biographies that we may have for ourselves, some may think that that's not an appropriate word, but I like the word. I really need to credit Tom Reagan, the philosopher who sadly just died less than a month ago, the American philosopher, for couching it that way, that animals have lives that are not just biology, but also biography. How do you measure a biography for a fish? I think you can certainly show they're unique. Really, it's not sticking one's neck out very far to say that all individual animals are unique. We could be talking about houseflies as well as elephants. It's in fact part of biology, part of evolution and genetic evolution and natural selection, that natural selection only works when there's variation. And so that's the crux of it, is individuals are different. But you can definitely measure it. You can see how some fishes have more bolder personalities and some are more retiring. Some are more quick to show fear. Others may be more adventurous. Some are more creative. Some are more outgoing. So there's a number of ways that can be measured. That's not to say there's been much study on that, but I think if one were to read my book, which I hope every reader and their cousins does, then one will come away with a sense that we are talking about animals who aren't just alive, but they have lives and they are unique individuals that express themselves in different ways.
My guest is Jonathan Balcom. He's a biologist, and he has just written a book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. And you spent 4 years working on this book, did you not?
Yeah, about 4 years. I mean, unfortunately, I haven't had the luxury of being a full-time writer of books. I've had to earn a living in other ways, and so that definitely impinges on my ability to devote the time that I would like to devote. I've made some changes to my own personal biography, and I now am able to devote more of my time to writing books because it's something I love doing, and so hopefully my next book will take more like 2 years rather than four.
Well, what inspired you to spend 4 years, devote 4 years to this book? Was there something when you were growing up that fascinated you about fishes?
Both. I mean, I'm on a mission. I consider animals my clients. They don't pay me with checks, but they reward me in so many other ways. And they've been my clients for over a quarter century now, since I graduated with a PhD in animal behavior back in 1992. So that's part of why I did this. I also want very much to rectify misconceptions that we have. I think it behooves humanity to be well informed about animals, and science is working away and revealing really neat stuff. I so admire the creativity and the ingenuity of scientists to come up with ways to reveal aspects of animal lives that are otherwise easily overlooked, especially animals who are living quite literally, not to mention figuratively, below the surface of our consciousness. I mean, fishes, they live in such a different world that we're only recently able to discover through technological advances like scuba and underwater photography. So with the knowledge that we have now about these creatures, combined with the rank underestimation that we've had of them, the rampant biases and prejudices that we've had against fishes as primitive, simple, cold-blooded creatures, that really makes for a story worth telling. And so I want to rectify the wrongs. I want to change how we understand them. And another part of that, of course, is our very troubled relationship with these animals. We're killing an estimated minimum of several hundred billion a year. That's billion with a B, possibly over 2 trillion, according to some estimates. Easy to forget they're all individuals, back to that biography point. And the way they die is pretty awful. Exsanguination, bleeding, suffocation, crushing in nets, decompression as they're raised from the depths. There's very little, if any, consideration given to them as individuals. So there's a lot that needs to be said, a lot that needs to change. I don't have any illusions that writing a book's going to change it all, but I think it's a good place to, it's a good contribution and an important place to start.
Well, you do have a paragraph in your book about the source of these prejudices that we have about or against fishes. You say in your book, you write, "I believe that the main source of our prejudices against fish is their failure to show expressions that we associate with having feelings." You say, Well, you say those flat, glassy eyes, we struggle to see anything more than a vacant stare. We hear no screams and see no tears when their mouths are impaled and their bodies pulled from the water. Their unblinking eyes, constantly bathed in water and thus no need of lids, amplify the illusion that they feel nothing. With a deficit of stimuli that normally trigger our sympathy, we are thus numbed to the fish's plight.
Yeah, indeed. They don't tend to trigger our sympathies, but do we rely on those kinds of wobbly kind of cues for assessing whether an animal can feel pain or can feel pleasure? Just before you dialed me, I was watching YouTube videos of tiger sharks swimming up in a friendly manner to trusted divers to receive face rubs, to get their faces massaged, and the tiger shark closes their secondary eyelid while they're getting these rubs. They turn around and come back. They're loving it. They're clearly loving it, and it's one of literally hundreds of videos one can now watch on YouTube of sharks receiving massages by, shall we say, rather courageous, but also, considerate divers who know these animals and who recognize how terribly we've mismeasured them. But even that isn't science in the sense that it's not a well-designed study. We can look at that sort of thing and we can take something away from that, and I think it's very powerful evidence. Nevertheless, there are studies that are looking closely at what kind of anatomy and behavior do you see in a painful situation, and the fishes meet the criteria that we expect for being able to feel pain and remember that experience and avoid it in future, and also to seek pain relief, which I think is a particularly compelling piece of evidence for pain, is if an animal is willing to make a sacrifice, that is to swim into a normally avoided, unpleasant, that is to say brightly lit and barren part of their tank, because the researchers have just dissolved some lidocaine there, a pain-relieving drug, and only the ones who've been injected with a painful acid will go and swim there. The ones injected with a relatively painless saline solution stay in the nice part of the tank. So that's just one example of a study, of several studies that I cite and describe briefly in the book, that shows that looking at things like eyelids and body temperature is not a very rigorous way to assess sentience, the capacity to feel pain, pleasure, emotions, and what have you. Doing studies that test them in carefully controlled experiments with large numbers of individuals, I think is a much more compelling way. And we really needn't do any more pain studies. The evidence is very clear. I mean, I think our intuitions should predict that they can feel pain. These are mobile organisms, complex. They've got the same 10 body systems we have. They have very well-developed senses and perceptions. They can move away from bad things. So, and we can watch videos of them enjoying belly rubs and swimming away from fishing hooks and that sort of thing. So there's, for every reason, we should not be debating anymore whether fishes feel pain. The debate should be closed. I say should be because it's not. There are still some who will make the case. But really, the science is quite clear that they're fully sentient animals.
I think it doesn't occur to us that fishes have these feelings, because we recognize when a dog or a cat comes over and wants to be petted. We understand when they might be hungry. We understand the signals. If a dog wags its tail a certain way, we have learned, I think, how to interpret signals from mammals. But fishes, it doesn't even occur to us that fishes could have anything to communicate to us.
And yet we can read about and can read studies and watch videos of studies that show the equivalent of your cat or your dog walking out on the street, seeing a cat, going over to the cat, saying something to the cat, and the cat and the dog go off together to cooperate to try and catch a mouse or something like that. Our jaws would drop if we saw that, I think. And yet that's the very type of behavior that moray eels and groupers do. They hunt cooperatively. Groupers give a particular signal, a head shake or a body shimmy, to a known moray, and the two will swim off over the reef and hunt cooperatively. And the scientists who describe this have studied it also in captivity and found that groupers will only recruit cooperative morays. They will favor cooperative ones over less effective partners, as we would do. So it's a sophisticated interspecies communication and cooperation, and it's in fishes. And if we saw it in some of the beloved mammals that we respect so highly, as we should, we would be very impressed. And so it's an example of how we tend to be blind to what's going on beneath the water. But if we look closely, there's some amazing things going on.
My guest is biologist Jonathan Balcom, and he specializes in animal behavior and emotions. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is biologist Jonathan Balcom, and he writes books on animal emotions. Your book is so fascinating because I could open any page at random and see something that, golly, I didn't know that. It's just, it really is packed with information that I think would really surprise people, and also fascinating. Things that we did not know about fishes.
Well, as a scientific writer, a writer of science, I've had to learn the lesson the hard way that fact after fact, frankly, doesn't necessarily convince people. It also doesn't entertain a lot of people. So I have learned to sprinkle the scientific information with compelling stories. Stories can reach our hearts in a way that science and facts tend to fail to do. They may reach our heads and our minds, which is helpful. But unless you engage a reader's or a listener's emotions, you're probably only going to go so far in motivating change. And change is what I want to see. I mean, I want to see changes in behavior. So, it is great that one can open just about any page of my book and perhaps learn something new about fishes. But you'll also find there's quite a lot of credible personal accounts of my own and from others who contributed to the book.
In fact, you open your book with a story about a young Jonathan Balcom that was really touching because I think most of us can recall some moment in our childhood when we were repulsed by the snuffing out of life to learn that we're eating what used to be an animal. And you say you went fishing and just you had a sensitivity for those poor earthworms.
I've always had a sensitivity for all animals, and I have to say, the way those earthworms writhe, it sure looks like they're feeling something. In fact, you could argue they show their pain more than a fish does. But yes, I was always particularly sensitive from my earliest memory. I think I would be one of the easiest. I was one of the easiest to convert to an animal rights person, somebody who really wants to see animals respected in a way that they traditionally haven't been. I want readers to know who I am and where I'm coming from. I want them to know me as an individual with feelings as well. I also have a biography. I'm also sentient. And I like to know who I'm reading when I read other people's books. So including my biography to some degree, I think is helpful in my books.
Well, I think you were typical as a child because you are repulsed by these poor suffering earthworms, and yet here's this nice man you've gone fishing with. He's a nice guy. You respect him. You like him. And you watch his reaction. What was his reaction to this whole process of fishing?
Yeah, it's hard to say what went on inside. I mean, Mr. Nelson was a great man. He was probably in his 60s at this time, which to me was ancient at the age of 8 that I was. I was at his funeral and many years later, and he was a very kind, sensitive man who made great contributions to the Society of Friends in Canada, whose summer camp I used to go to north of Toronto. But like so many of us, you know, we express ourselves in different ways, and he'd probably become inured to the plight of the fish. I mean, that's how we're socialized. I was introduced to fishing by him, and he loved to fish, and he would take young campers out fishing, and I enjoyed the experience, but as I say in the book, he did all the dirty work. I didn't have to bait the hooks. I didn't have to pull them out of the fish's faces. I wasn't plunging the knife into the larger ones who were kept for breakfast the next day and then putting them into the basket hanging over the side of the boat. I saw it. I saw it all, and it deeply disturbed me, but I didn't have to do it. And so it didn't reach into my heart in such a way as it probably would have if I had to actually carry out those tasks. Nevertheless, it left an impression. And I soon lost whatever enthusiasm I had from that first occasion when it came time to bait my own hooks. As for him, I never asked him how he felt. I never asked him why his face was contorting the way it was when he was busily doing the tasks that to me looked very unsavory. I would love to ask him. I would ask him today if I could. I have spoken to fishermen. I have spoken to hunters. Generally, they say they don't really enjoy the moment of killing. I think they enjoy other aspects, the stalk, the chase, the hunt, the anticipation, the excitement. I get it. I'm a nature lover and an outdoorsman. I'm a bird watcher. I try not to take. I don't kill. But I love to go out and face the challenge of, how many kinds of warblers am I going to see in this woodland today? So in that regard, there are some parallels there. And so I understand the thrill. I just would love to see us move away from types of outdoor adventures that involve harming and causing others to suffer. I think we can get the adventure and the thrills in other ways, creative ways, without doing that.
My guest is Jonathan Balcom, and his latest book is What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. And people, I'm sure, out there thinking, okay, well, that's nice. You say that fish have self-awareness, but you can't interview the fish. How can you go about finding out? You cite the case of some giant manta rays that you did a study, not you personally, but two marine biologists. And what did they learn about self-awareness in manta rays?
Yeah, it's an example of a preliminary study that the primary author, Scylla Ari, she is very clear to note that this is a preliminary study. She is not showing any kind of scientific proof, although most scientists would say there's no such thing anyway, but that's another story. But really, it involved only two manta rays in a captive setting. Nevertheless, she presented information that was consistent with the capacity to be recognizing oneself in a mirror, which is considered sort of the litmus test for self-recognition or self-awareness in a non-human who can't just tell you or write down what they're thinking. So you present them with a mirror, and then you ideally put a mark on them that they don't know the mark is there, and also they can't see it on themselves, but they can see it in the mirror. And then you see if they change their behavior, if they notice the mark, and if they try to remove it from their bodies or what have you. Not sure how a manta ray would even do that. You can see how some of these challenges arise that get in the way of trying to answer the question. That's why scientists do need to be innovative and clever. But anyway, if the animal does indicate an awareness of the mark when they see the reflection of themselves in the mirror, rather than, say, making a threat display or swimming or running away or trying to look behind the mirror, all of which may suggest that the animal thinks it's somebody else, those kinds of responses suggest that the animal is self-aware. We should be cautious of interpreting that test. I think if the animal, quote-unquote, passes the mirror test and tries to remove the mark on the body, as chimps have done, as magpies have done, as elephants and dolphins have done, and other great apes, then that's maybe pretty rigorous support for self-awareness. But I would say that, quote-unquote, failure of the mirror self-recognition test is not strong evidence of lack of self-awareness. And indeed, there's emerging evidence that a number of animals who have previously been considered to be not self-aware owing to the failure in this mirror self-recognition test, I think some monkeys are an example, there's probably some others, have now been shown to appear to be self-aware on other ways of measuring and other axes. So, but I think it's exciting in two ways. That we're finding evidence, say, in manta rays. I mean, okay, manta rays. Wow, that's really cool. Manta rays have very big brains. They have, I think, about the biggest brains of any fish. But it's also exciting that we're asking the questions, and that's one of the reasons why I like to say it's an exciting time to be an ethologist, to be a student of animal behavior. And because scientists are asking questions that half a century ago were not being asked, because there was a real stricture against really delving into the possibility that animals might think and feel.
Yeah, because we assume they're just instinct-driven. They go by their instincts, and that's what determines their behavior. And it's rather surprising to read in your book that their minds respond flexibly to different situations.
I love that word, flexibly. That gets back to the individuality as well. You see, it's not just that, wow, they're intelligent, they have that solution for that problem. Well, beyond that, you can find that they're intelligent, this individual has that solution, and then this one has a different solution. One of many cognition studies I describe in the book was a study of problem solving by a kind of stingray, in which they were presented with food items that were tucked into a plastic tube that was open at both ends in some case, closed at one end in other cases. But in any event, they found that these individuals, it was a small study, I think there were five stingrays in the study, but they found that individuals were idiosyncratic in how they solved these problems, that different individuals have different methods that they use. Some tried to blow water through the tube to get the food to come out the other side. Others created suction with their mouths or with their fins. And then when they made it challenging, where the fish actually had to go around the other side of the tube to get the food out, they had to move away from the food to actually get it to get out, to be removed, they found that they would solve that problem. So it was a really interesting little study. Again, another study that I think, based on its small sample size, is preliminary, but nevertheless points to these animals having much more cognitive awareness than we might have thought in the past.
My guest is Jonathan Balcom. He's a biologist who specializes in animal behavior and emotions. And his most recent book is What a Fish Knows. And I think people will be surprised to learn that fishes use tools. Because I remember in past years, we said, okay, this is what distinguishes humans, Homo sapiens, from animals. We use tools, they don't.
Yeah, they're at a little bit of a disadvantage because they don't have grasping hands. Most animals don't have grasping hands, but they do have mouths and fins, and indeed they can use tools. And there's a very nice YouTube video filmed by Giacomo Bernardi from the University of California, I think Santa Cruz, who was the first to film what looks to be it's pretty clearly tool use. In fact, more than one kind of tool use by a tuskfish, which is a member of the wrasse family. Tuskfishes seem to be particularly enterprising, but certainly you can see other tool-like behavior in other fishes. Certainly fishes use water as a tool, and this particular video, this tuskfish is blowing water on the sand to uncover a mollusk. The fish then grabs the mollusk and carries it away. What struck me was when I say blowing the water, you think of the fish blowing water through the mouth, which they will often do. But this tuskfish doesn't do that. Again, being idiosyncratic, this tuskfish faces away from the sand and closes the operculum, which is the gill cover, a little bit like rapidly snapping a book closed, and you get that puff of wind from the book. Similarly, you get a puff of water from the snapping of the gill cover, an incredibly enterprising way of making water move. And by doing that, the water removes the sand, and then the fish grabs the mollusk and swims in a very purposeful manner in a particular direction. Stops at a little rock on the way, tries to smash open the clam, gives up with that, and swims on to a much larger rock further away. Now, these animals live in relatively small habitats. They know their turf. They know their area. They know their surf, not their turf. But they know their local habitat. I'm sure this fish knows that rock and had the premonition of saying to him or herself, I'm going to use that rock as an anvil. They wouldn't use that language, but I'm going to use that to smash this unfortunate mollusk. And that's what the fish does, with a series of very well-timed, well-coordinated head flicks and releases to smash this mollusk, this little clam, against the rock until it's smashed open and the fish can get at the insides. It's a sequence of behaviors that I see as planning. I also describe the remarkable athleticism of freshwater tiger fishes from South African lakes. These tiger fishes have learned to ambush swallows flying over the water at probably 20, 25 miles an hour. So these fishes are somehow able to swim faster than that and then leap out from behind and catch them. I consider that as not a willy-nilly behavior. That's a planned behavior. That's something that takes planning and immense coordination and physical ability. So we can find other examples where fishes are defying our prejudices and actually performing sophisticated sequences of behavior that we one time probably wouldn't have thought them capable of doing.
Well, you mentioned they're leaping, and you tell about the frill fin goby and how it jumps and why it jumps. Tell us about that fish.
Yeah, quite a few fishes leap in different ways. There's a photo, a beautiful photo in my book of Mobula rays, which perform these beautiful 6 foot high, sometimes 10 foot high leaps out of the water. Sometimes they somersault and they slap down really loudly. These are fishes that are going to have a wingspan of 10 feet. And they seem to be courting, but I think there's probably also joy in that behavior. We have flying fishes who use leaping out of the water to get away from larger predator fish. And then we have the frillfin goby, who lives in the intertidal zone, so that area between where the water is at high tide and where it isn't at low tide. And they are able to leap from one tide pool to another very accurately. They know which direction and how far to jump to get to the next one if some octopus comes lurking or some other reason they want to get out of there. The question is, how do they know that? How do they avoid ending up stranded on the rocks?
Because you say that to our eyes, that poor fish doesn't look too smart.
Well, you know, it's funny how we have these biases. You know, I mean, it's just an ordinary little brown mottled 5-inch long fish with a somewhat pouty mouth and a somewhat stern expression. Of course, that's not a very rigorous way to assess what's going on in their brain. But it turns out they, in a series of very well-designed captive studies done back as far as the late 1940s by a scientist named Lester Aronson, who was at the New York Museum of Natural History. So these fishes unwittingly ended up in a laboratory in downtown New York City. And these studies, by setting up artificial reefs and giving these fishes the opportunity to swim over his reef at quote-unquote high tide, when the water was over, he found that they explored and investigated the nooks and crannies of the habitat he'd created at high tide. And then when it was low tide, when the water was drained out and there were just these ponds left, these fishes who'd had that experience knew how far to leap when he stuck a stick in their pond that had a heron-like beak, so it looked like a big predatory bird. They would leap accurately with about, I think, 98% accuracy to neighboring ponds. If those unfortunate ones who were in the control group who didn't have a high tide to swim over and learn the topography, their success rate at landing in a neighboring pond was about 15%. So they would still jump out of desperation, but they didn't know where they were jumping. So a very clear demonstration of what we call not just memory, but mental mapping, forming a mental map. And Aronson found that they could form that map with just one high tide experience, and that they remembered it 40 days later. So much for the 3-second goldfish memory of myth.
Yeah, that's pretty surprising, because we might wonder, well, if you say they have a good memory, how do you test for memory? And there's an example. These fish remembering something 40 days later.
Yes, memory is a very testable phenomenon. And another statement that I thought was quite striking from a fish biologist from Australia named Cullen Brown. He's at the Macquarie University. I think it was him, actually, maybe in Redouane Bashari. You know, you study fish biologists, and some of them start to become sort of celebrities. It's like, wow, this guy's done some amazing studies. Well, Redouane Bashari is sort of a superstar among fish social cognition researchers, and he's at the University of Neuchâtel in Switzerland. And I think it was him who said, we've yet to be a study of social behavior in fishes in which the individuals don't recognize each other as individuals. So individual recognition is pretty much routine for schooling or shoaling fishes. And that, of course, requires memory to know one individual from one day, one week, one month to the next. Requires that you have a brain that can remember something from the past. And also, recent studies find that fishes can recognize humans by our faces as well.
I think people would find that surprising.
And how do you even determine that? You know, back to that question, you know, what methods do we use? Well, they cleverly used a fish that has a particular biology that makes them well suited to preference studies. They used archer fishes, which use water as a tool. They squirt water from their mouths to catch flying insects who are flying by. That's impressive in its own right, and there's a lot more can be said about them in that regard. But it also means you can train them to have a choice of, say, a panel that's above the water with a picture of one human face on one side and another human face on the other side. And even if you've taken the hair away, so you've got reduced cues, maybe no ears visible, just based on the arrangement of the eyes, nose, and mouth, and chin, they will squirt water at their preferred target. And you can find that they will, when they're trained to be rewarded for a particular face, and then you present that face among other faces that they haven't been exposed to before, they will squirt water at the familiar face. So they're recognizing human faces over time.
I'll be back with my guest, Jonathan Balcom, after a short break, and we'll continue our conversation about animal emotions and the inner life of fish. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is biologist Jonathan Balcom, and he has written a book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. Now, you mentioned in your book some interesting facts about how fishes are named. One is named for a nature documentary presenter. Who was that?
Oh, you almost stumped me there. I think it's Matterpiscus attenboroughi.
Yeah,
Attenborough. Meaning mother fish, and attenboroughi, of course, named for the iconic British television nature presenter David Attenborough.
Yeah, so that's one way a fish might get its name. And then you also mentioned what the longest fish name is, and I won't ask you to pronounce that, but where does...
Oh, that's
what?
Too bad.
I
love saying that one. I say it in all my fish talks. Yeah, the English name is a lovely name in itself, the Picasso triggerfish. That's a lovely name for a really gorgeously colored fish, but the native Hawaiians call it the Humuhumu Nuku Nuku Apua'a. And that apparently stands for the fish who sews with a needle and that grunts like a pig.
Yeah, even the name itself is onomatopoeic, isn't it?
It's a beautiful name, yeah. I kind of have to say, even though I like Picasso triggerfish, I'll go with the Hawaiian name any day.
Well, for fun, say it one more time.
Humuhumu nuku nuku apua'a.
So that's...
There will be a quiz on that at the end of the show.
Right. What's the longest fish name? Well, you also mentioned a name that's not very flattering in your book. Do you remember what you mentioned for that? The award for the least flattering name?
Yes, I think my great aunt would be quite insulted if she was referred to as a sarcastic fringe head. But, or actually, I think the hairy-jawed sack mouth may be the least flattering, and the sarcastic fringe head might be the most outrageous. Those are names, by the way, for deep-sea anglerfishes, which probably don't give a damn what they look like because they live in a permanently dark environment.
So a hairy-jawed sack mouth, and the other was a sarcastic fringe head.
You're becoming an expert in fish names, I see.
Was that some of the interesting tidbits of information that you give us in your book? You also, there's a section about sexual matters and regarding fish, because we don't think of fish as particularly sexual. What did you learn about that?
Oh, there's so much. I've also learned as a science writer, well, any a writer of any kind of book, if you can get sex in there, it's going to sell a few more copies. And that's not the only reason I do it, because I do want people to know that animals have sex lives. I've written two books about animal pleasure, and sex is predictably figured large in those two books. And I wanted to include something about the reproductive natural history of fishes, although I think sex life sounds more exciting than reproductive natural history. And certainly, with the incredible diversity of fishes, I mean, we're talking a group of animals of which there are more species, about 32,000 known, possibly as many as 40,000 yet to be once we discover them all, which is more than all of the other vertebrates combined. So as you may expect from that, there's a rich diversity of sexual and reproductive expression. There are, in fact, there's something like 30, I think it's 38 or maybe it's 32 reproductive systems, whatever that means. That's maybe not very helpful, but it once again, it's more than all the other vertebrates combined. So you have everything from monogamy to various forms of polygamy, polyandry, polygyny. You have conventional sex. You have deception. You have males who imitate females to get sneak copulations in when the big dominant male is not looking or doesn't realize that they're actually competing males. You have the bizarrely named sexual parasitism, which happens in deep sea anglerfishes, where males never grow to be more than a fraction of the size of females, and they, if they find the appropriate female, they bite onto her body. It doesn't really matter where, and they latch on and they become fused to her for the rest of their lives, and they share her bloodstream and inseminate her intravenously. So we have some pretty bizarre stuff. We have sex changes without expensive surgery, where fishes can go from male to female one day and then back to male in the next day in some species. Sometimes it's unidirectional, you can only do it once. We have courtship that involves artistry, where some fishes will create artistic designs and mating platforms, a bit like bowerbirds do, and to attract and allure mates who don't lay their eggs there. They just get wooed there, and then if they accept the male, they mate, and then she goes off somewhere to have her eggs. So that's just a few examples of some of the rich diversity of sexual reproductive patterns that you find in fishes.
Well, you earlier talked about how fish were able to plan, and if they're planning, or maybe they don't have to plan, but you say they do help each other out. And when they hunt cooperatively. We know that lions do this. Lions get together and they together can bring down the antelope or whatever they're chasing. But I don't think it would occur to us that fishes do that.
Yeah, there's two kinds of levels of cooperative hunting by fishes. There's within species cooperative hunting, where you may get a phalanx of tunas, for instance, or various other kinds of species, mackerels, predatory species of the ocean, who will hunt strategically in groups. Where they will line up and charge at prey fishes and corral them and that sort of thing. Now, that's impressive in its own right, and that's quite analogous to the lion type of cooperative hunting. But you also see, which is very rare in nature, you see interspecific cooperation, as we mentioned before with the grouper and the moray eel.
That's what surprised me, that a moray eel would join with another kind of fish. And because to do this, to hunt cooperative, they would have to be able to communicate with each other.
Indeed, and there is communication going on. You can watch a YouTube video of a wild grouper fish swimming over a reef, coming up to a moray eel who's just poking his or her head out of the reef, and the grouper swims over and does a head shake. It's a very clear physical, visual gesture, and it translates to its grouper speak for, will you come hunting with me? I'm hungry. I want to go hunting and try and catch some food. Are you going to come with me? And if the moray's in the mood, the moray swims out, and they swim off over the reef. They look like a couple of Disney characters on a stroll. And they hunt cooperatively, and the studies show that their per capita success rate is higher when they hunt as a team. And the reason for that is morays are kind of like ferrets of the sea. They're slender and narrow. They can chase little fishes into the nooks and crannies of the reef where those fishes will escape. If the fish is not caught by the moray eel, then it's likely to swim out into the open to flee. And of course, who's waiting there? The big, chunky, fast-swimming grouper, who will pounce on that unfortunate little fish when it comes out. So because of that combination of different hunting skills, They're a pretty ruthless combination and a very successful one for the two parties who were cooperating with each other.
Yeah, that's hard to imagine because fish don't have arms or legs or facial expressions. Now, we do know dolphins make noises, but here, the grouper and the moray eel, and they communicate with their whole body, really, and their head.
And what gets me with that kind of thing, Nancy, is how does it arise? You know, how did it start? Was there an Einstein grouper who sort of just had the idea one day, you know, let me just do this head shake and see if this moray does something? I mean, it's just remarkable. I mean, the complexity of behaviors that you can find across the pantheon of species in the animal kingdom, including in some invertebrates, animals without backbones, is just amazing. And there's so many that leave me scratching my head. And I think, well, it's just remarkable what it is. But also, how did it arise? How did it get there? How did it start? Who originated it? There have to be some very creative, innovative innovators among animals out there, because these things don't arise from nothing.
My guest is Jonathan Balcom, and he's relating how there today is a steady stream of discoveries about how fishes think and feel and live their lives. There's a fish you call cleaner fishes, and they, I don't know if you say make their living, but what do they do for a living?
I do say that, in fact, yes. Their mode of existence is to, well, the way they feed themselves, which is pretty critical, is to remove parasites, algae, bits of skin, and sometimes mucus from the bodies of so-called client fishes, which of more than 100 described species will line up to wait their turn to be serviced by these cleaners, typically on reefs, although it's found elsewhere as well. But cleaners work individually or in pairs, sometimes in trios and small groups. They have a particular area of the reef that they will inhabit, and they ply their trade there every day. They're very busy. They can service over 2,000 fish in one day. And these client fish line up to wait their turn, and when it's their turn, they swim up to the station, a little bit like going to the barber shop to have your hair cut.
Or a spa treatment, you say?
Or a spa treatment, yes, I think it's a fair analogy. And they hover there, wait their turn, and then they get plucked over. The clients cooperate actively. They will open their mouths to allow the cleaners to swim in. They'll open their gill covers to allow the cleaners to go in and remove some little sea lice or whatever may be unwanted there. And so it's a classic mutualism, a plus-plus relationship. Both parties benefit. The client gets a spa treatment and a parasite removal service, and the cleaner gets food. And it's a very, very well-studied social phenomenon, and there's a lot to be said about it. I mean, I'm just brushing the surface of what I've said so far.
Well, and you mentioned that if a cleaner fish oversteps and nips a client's skin, these other clients say, uh-oh, I think I'll go find a different cleaner fish. This guy's too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's called mucus nipping, and it turns out that slimy layer on the outside of the fish's skin is a very nutritious layer. It's important to the client fish because it protects them from various unwanteds like algae, and it may provide some parasite protection. Cleaner fishes will sometimes overstep their bounds and take a little nip. They probably know that they shouldn't be doing it. Clients typically jolt. They have a body jolt, which I suspect not only maybe as a result of pain or discomfort, but it may also be a signal to the cleaner that the client is onto them. They know that they shouldn't have done that. It also signals to other waiting clients that these cleaners may be not doing a great job. Studies show that jolting, mucus nipping and jolting, is more common when there are fewer clients in the queue. This is what you'd call an audience effect. So the cleaners are aware of who's watching and how many. And if you only have a couple of clients, well, there's less of a penalty. You've got less to lose. And if you have a lot of future customers waiting in the queue, there's a relationship between the quality of the service and the number of customers that are present at that time. So it is pretty Machiavellian and complicated.
In fact, you suggest that it's like Yelp with kelp.
You know, I have to credit someone else with that.
Okay.
It's a little bit like eBay ratings as well, and that's another element where clients actually, they have a cumulative score, what's called an impression, they call it image scoring, where the clients, over time, they watch the performance of the cleaners and they have a sort of a rating. So it's a little bit like eBay sales ratings, where based on the past performance of the eBay seller, they get a rating. And so that also influences whether the client is likely to come back for future services from that particular cleaner.
You earlier mentioned that fish do like to swim over to divers and get stroked and get petted. But you even say moray eels will cuddle with trusted divers.
There's a particular YouTube video, so this isn't based on a scientific study. In fact, I'd like scientists to do more studies on pleasure-related phenomena like this. But certainly you can watch a YouTube video of a cactus situation, a very large, probably 6-foot-long green moray eel, who is engaged with this diver who's cleaning the tank. It's one of these large tanks. The diver's in the tank. And the diver manhandles this eel a bit more than I think would be preferable. I've watched the video many times. It's a little hard to tell how much the eel is into it. But the eel is pretty, part of the interaction and engaged, and appears to be enjoying much of the interaction. And we're talking pretty vigorous body hugging and face rubbing that the eel is receiving from the diver.
Well, we know that in humans, this kind of attention, stroking and petting is quite therapeutic.
Yes, and there's probably, I would say, just about the most compelling, or at least my favorite study. Well, it's hard to say it's my favorite. I mean, they stressed the fishes. I felt bad for these fishes in this study. But it's a really, really telling study of surgeon fishes who were captured in the wild off the Great Barrier Reef, and they stressed them by putting them in a bucket of water for 30 minutes, a small bucket of water. Probably a pretty scary experience for these individual fishes. They don't know if they're going to be left there forever, right? So in any event, they took them out after 30 minutes. You can measure their stress levels. The cortisol in the blood was much higher. And then fishes who were given the opportunity to get strokes, strokes from a cleaner fish wand, a model of a cleaner fish painted to look like one that moved back and forth mechanically in the corner of their tank after this stressful experience, they would swim up to that and repeatedly and get stroked, and their stress levels would come down. Stressed fishes who didn't have the option, they had the control was a stationary wand, a stationary cleaner fish that didn't move back and forth. They ignored it. They couldn't get any strokes from it. So it was a very clear study showing that a massage is therapeutic for a fish, not just for a human. And I'm happy to say they released those surgeon fishes back in their home territories on the Great Barrier Reef after the study was completed.
Jonathan Balcom is the author of What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.